The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Management of cardiac arrhythmias and conduction disorders is presented by Dr. Robert Chilton.
Well, and Fair was about, he had to cover a lot of material, and so I have to hand it to him. That was a tough. Mine's really pretty simple. This part, I focused on just the arrhythmia and conduction system, and I've put in here what I think, if I was going to ask you, which I didn't ask these questions, so I will tell you what I think I would pick for the boards for most of you. So to start with, let's take a look at the first one. Look at that rhythm a little bit. It's small, but you're going to see it blown up in just a minute. Here's another one for you. You need to know and identify that one. The first one was a treadmill. The second one's just a routine cowboy. Down here is another one that didn't do well. He was running and just crashed. And then down here is a lady that had a biopsy of her breast. So would you just leave her alone? Or she's feeling fine. Over here is two that you have to know for advanced life support, so you should know those for sure. Let's start with the first one. This is where it comes from. You have that in your handout already. And this is a guy that's 50-some years old, two-vessel heart disease, had a cath a couple of months before, hits the emergency room, but he had passed out. And so they brought him in and transferred him to CCU. He didn't have a heart attack. Troponins are negative. But since he had syncope, you got a cath there that's got some blocks in it. It's kind of bothersome. Patient was referred for electrophysiology testing, and they induced sustained monomorphic VTAC. So what would be your best option here? So I'll go through these and kind of take a look at them with you. But that would be somebody that you might potentially have, although it's a little out of the scope of primary care, but at least you'll start thinking about what many of us have to deal with every day. This is the answer. If you pass out, you're going to get a defibrillator if we don't know, if you infarct it. If you have frank syncope and you are a guy that's doing whatever you're doing, that is something that you have to put a defibrillator in for. That's a class one. And you can see you need to exclude reversible causes, though, if somebody's hypokalemic or something like that. The other one is down at the bottom, ischemic heart disease, like I showed you this guy, in unexplained syncope, who has inducible VTAC in the electrophysiology lab, he gets a defibrillator implant. The reason is because many of them die again. If you have a guy that passes out without ischemic heart disease and no ischemic disease on cath, and you follow them out, they die at the rate of 30% per year, again, because you never figured it out. So we put defibrillators in those folks. So that's part number one. Now here's another one. So for the board exam, I'd give you a person. This is a young guy who would come in and he'd say, you know, I am asymptomatic, but I've got a neuromuscular disorder. His question to you is, I've been reading on the internet. So which one am I not a candidate for an ICD? He's asymptomatic. He needs a heart cath to evaluate his coronary disease. I guess if you're a cardiologist, it might be good for business. If you look down there, patient has a neuromuscular disorder, primary or secondary prevention, you should put one in on either one. And maybe he needs an EP study, or maybe the patient should have a documented complete heart block before his workup. So, you know, if you look at those answers and stuff, you say, well, which one would that be? We'll look at them and see. So here's the answer. He's a class one. Patients with neuromuscular disorders in primary or secondary prevention, you need an ICD as recommended for non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. So if you have that and a patient rolls in, you say, gosh, I wasn't aware that was so important. Well, if you start looking at the literature, look at all my red arrows and look at all these different ones. If you don't even remember them, if they give you one of these on the boards, pick one. It looks like to me heart disease is pretty prominent. So you might want to consider that the reason that's a class one is death is not something that's infrequent. It's something that we really watch for. So watch for that one. And again, you'll have an electrophysiologist that'll be putting it in anyway, but you will be the first person on the block to recognize it in something that a patient could walk in. And I actually had one walked in, had never seen an electrophysiology guy. And I do EP myself, and I can tell you, you have to be aware of these guidelines because they change. So now the literature is pretty robust. We have more gene marking, and we can tell a lot of these people. Here's another one, asymptomatic 34-year-old. She goes in for a Bass biopsy. This is another patient of mine. And so what happened is they have a QT that was over 470 milliseconds. So do you put a defibrillator in her because she has a long QT and she has long repolarization, she might fibrillate? Or do you just give her a beta blocker? Or do you say, you're asymptomatic, no big deal, just go heavy biopsy, no big deal? So then if you look at the literature, what's new in the guidelines? Well, here's congenital long QT. In patients with long QTs with a QT more than 470, they recommend a beta blocker. So don't forget to do that. If they come in, they give you a real long QT. I think that's something to consider. You can also see there's three other things listed there. Class one, high-risk patients with symptomatic long QT, beta blocker is ineffective, not tolerated. They end up with an ICD. Now, that came out of a lot of the studies that we did years ago when we found out that we could overdrive people that actually had long QTs with different kinds of drugs. Beta blockers just will not protect them. But for somebody that's asymptomatic that comes in with a long QT and that's all you have, then a beta blocker is okay. But if you've got somebody that's symptomatic with long QT, you probably need to have electrical box put in, and that would be helpful to you. But you can read those on your own. Notice down there, class one, genetic counseling and genetic testing are recommended, and certainly the offspring of that person might be worthwhile looking. If they had it, they may be a candidate also. These are the high-risk features that make you die if you have long QT. You have one over 500 milliseconds. These are the two genotypes. These are not hard to get. You can order them, and they'll do them quite commonly. Probably Salt Lake City does the most of them. The female genotype is especially high risk. A younger person that's passed out that has long QT is a problem. And then if you have a symptom onset that's relatively new, or you have recurrent syncope. I've had these before in my practice, and I can tell you, you will see them. I'm at a quaternary referral center, so we do see weird cases roll in. But you will be the one sending them to a lot of us, so watch for these. These are not totally out of, you'll never see one. You probably will find one that rolls across your desk. This shows you the actual algorithm for the long QT, and it shows you again the long 470. Again, beta blocker, and then you can see the defibrillator is placed in the ones that had really significant problems. But again, be sure you check for causes. Now, here's another one that is not infrequent that the house staff thought you guys would like this one. This is, I have to say, courtesy of a couple of ladies that are my interventional fellows. And basically, here's a guy that has a treadmill, and so they bring him over from the non-invasive lab, say, gosh, look at this. We did a cath this guy immediately. So what has he got? You look at that rhythm and it's all over the darn place, you know, and then you have to ask the questions. Does he have monomorphic VTAC and ECCU mid, or does he just need an ICD immediately? Or is it just exercise-induced polymorphic VTAC that's catecholamine driven and he just needs a beta blocker? Or is a patient that no benefit from a beta blocker, it's contraindicated, and maybe he needs IV amiodarone? Now, you know, he settled back down, didn't have any more. But during exercise, that's pretty impressive for most of you. So if you had that, would you want me to put a box in you, or you want what? So let's go to the guidelines. So here's what it says. It gives you a person with catecholamine, which means you're exercised and you're exercising at the gym, polymorphic VTAC, it's a class one for a beta blocker. But it didn't put a defibrillator. But if you are symptomatic and you crash, that's a different ball game. Would you cath that patient? I think if he had high risk factors, I probably would cath him. But if he has nothing, then catecholamine driven is going to be hard to just, you know, other than put a box in him, you're going to have to give him a drug to decrease the catecholamine surge. And usually these guys have had incidences of passing out. However, this guy had not. He was a military guy. So it's around. People do have this. But again, don't get too excited. Just add the beta blocker and you can re-treadmill him and see how well he does. Here's another one. patient brought in by an ambulance after apparent cardiac arrest, no chest pain, negative troponins, that's your EKG. That EKG alone is enough to diagnose it. You should recognize this. You look at it and you say, gosh, that's the weirdest looking V1 I've ever seen. Is that a right bundle? Is that an ST elevation MI? Is that not an MI? The computer reads it as an MI. So which one does he got? Takotsubo's? Bugatta? Right ventricular infarction because it's over there on the right side? A non-STEMI? Or is that a left bundle branch block? But in V4, 5, and 6, it's not too wide. But definitely, if you look at V1, doesn't it look kind of weird? So it's a great test question because either you know it or you don't. And what this ends up being, this shows up as Borgata syndrome. And there's some, again, blown up views of it. But notice what it says, outlined in red. Patients with spontaneous type 1, they are the ones that can have a cardiac arrest. And so the recent history of syncope, presumed VA ventricular arrest, those people need an ICD. And that's where it still sits today. At one time, there's two family members that write this, Borgata's two people. They actually said, well, you know, I'll just give them amiodarone because they're not from the United States. They came back after they had said, well, they've diagnosed this brand new syndrome. They got their name on it. They gave them amio. Patient still died. Then they said, you know, we probably ought to put a defibrillator in them. So that's where it is now today. So if you got Borgata syndrome, you're going to get a defibrillator. You probably get a beta blocker to shut down the number of shocks you get, but you won't get only a drug. You're going to need more than that. Here's another one. This is more of a squirrely one, although if you guys see primary care patients, you guys probably have people that have atrial fibrillation. And let's say that the guy has hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is big old thick ventricle. You can see it there up in the corner of the slide. Now, if he's got AFib, you're going to say, well, you know, I probably ought to do a CHADS VAS score. So you want to calculate that up, and I put them both there so you'd have a chance to calculate them. And then I'm going to ask you the question. Patient does not require any anticoagulation since he has a low score. In this guy, he would have a low score. Patient requires ticagrelor. Maybe that's a platelet blocking agent that would be helpful. Upregulates adenosine, but at the same time, maybe it's not indicated. Or does he need something like anticoagulation is independent from a CHADS VAS score, so you don't even need to calculate it. He's got a hypertroph and he's got AFib, and no matter what his score is, he's still going to get anticoagulated with a 10A probably or a direct thrombin inhibitor. So there you go. Where do we go from there? So let's go to the guidelines. So for this one, the guy has a HOCM, and the guidelines have a class 1, and it says anticoagulation is indicated for hypertroph with AFib independent of whatever your calculated CHADS VAS score is. So no matter what this guy is, he's still going to get either something like apixaban or dabigatran or one of those drugs as a 10A because he needs to have it because he's got a hypertroph. So for those, watch for these. These are ones that are not real common, but again are around, and AFib is real common currently. Here's another one. AFib in a setting of acute coronary syndrome is urgent cardioversion. You need to do that if the guy's rate is not controlled. That's a class 1. AV beta blockers is another one. And certainly, as I talked this morning when I talked about chronic stable angina or people with it, the thing that eats up oxygen during acute coronary syndrome is heart rate. I'd like you to slow that down, and you can kind of pick what you like. Acute coronary syndrome and AFib with a CHADS VAS greater than 2, then warfarin is recommended unless contraindicated. So it's a little bit different than we've seen in the past. I think the 10As now have pretty much beat out the warfarin. Quite honestly, I don't use warfarin very much anymore. It would be probably a valve case. Most everybody's on a 10A or a direct thrombin inhibitor, and you can pick your choice, whichever you want. If you've got AFib and your CHADS VAS is high, you need to be on one of those. This shows you the people to watch out with low ejection fractions. And the reason I like this one is because most of you are not aware of watching for the left ventricle. If you're going to try to slow somebody's heart rate down, you need to know what the guy's ejection fraction is if it's rapid atrial fibrillation in somebody that's older that's have ischemic disease. If they have a low ejection fraction, you don't want to use verapamil to do it because you're going to really get them into trouble. They'll put them in pulmonary edema. Beta blockers are very difficult to work with sometimes. So you're left with using diltiazem. It is the most, it is probably the least negative inotropic drug that you can pick. So if you have a chronic pulmonary disease patient that can't take a beta blocker, he's got a low ejection fraction, you can pick this one, and it works quite well. You just keep titrating it up to slow the rate around 100 or so, but 170 is not going to cut it. Now, at the very bottom of the slide, there's digoxin. Digoxin is the only drug that we currently own that is a negative dromotropic drug. It will not affect the ejection fraction. It might even increase it a little bit, but it will slow conduction. So that one is a good one to pick if you have somebody that is extremely low ejection fraction and you can't control them. The only downside is I can't control them very fast with that drug. It takes time to load them. And then if they do convert into sinus rhythm and you have a high dig level, they will become dig toxic. Dig toxicity is not that the level they measure, it's the symptoms onset that they have. But they match pretty close, so be careful with that. And also, if you want to look at the guy's potassium level, if his heart rate is still running really fast and his potassium is 3.5, if you raise it to around 4, you will then produce a conduction block through the conduction circuits and slow him down even more. So you would like to have an elevated potassium to some extent on some of these patients that really have very fast rates. That will help you control them a lot easier. If you have somebody with chronic pulmonary disease and the guy has a low ejection fraction, extremely fast rate in AFib, and you want to give a drug, diltiazem is a great choice, but make sure his potassium is 4 and higher, and you'll probably find it works pretty good, but not toxic level. You can use amiodarone for some of these. It takes a little bit more to do, but by and large right now, I think AFib is best treated with the beta blocker or diltiazem. Over on this one, it shows you the contraindication for amiodarone in a special group of people. Person's got WPW with pre-excitation. I think most of you say you can use amio for everything. That's not what it says. It says harm. I only ask two types of questions when we write questions. One is harm, and one is class one. I don't ask class two. So go to the guidelines, pick the ones that fit your area of topic, and pull those guidelines and look at the executive summary. Now, if it's in cardiology, you go to the American College of Cardiology's website, you look under HUB, H-U-B, ACC/HUB, it will give you 10 most common things that you must know about this topic area. If you don't even read the executive guidelines, is let's say you're crashed, you've been up all night, and you just are really trying to get ready for the boards, then go to that website. It will have all of our guideline papers, but specifically look at the one called HUB. We have outlined that, and you can find it on the ACC app on your phone, but it's also in text in the journal. So watch for those. Those are helpful. Again, on this, notice WPW with pre-excitation. I've outlined and read two other ones you have to be aware of. You need to know about procaine amide and ibutalide to restore rhythm. That also shows a reasonable help and is something to watch for. So those two are some that you need to know. On this slide shows you the actual catheter ablation is recommended for first line therapy with paroxysmal AFib. It's a class two though, it's not a class one. AFib ablations are getting better. They're not perfect, because they have problems with finding and actually giving a good conduction block. But they have become and moved up to almost class one in some people's minds. I think for the boards, if they offer something like that, it'll probably be a reasonable choice if the patient's already tried medication. But again, don't forget prophylaxis, because they will definitely not miss that. This shows you again, the one in the arrow is the one I want you to look at. Implant an ICD for primary fibrillation is not recommended for the first 3 months of a person that has a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. The reason is because sometimes these guys recover and you don't need to put the defibrillator in. Defibrillators are not perfect. They do have false shocks. They do get infected, as I have one right now that's got the lead and the can infected, and EF is 10%. Nobody's going to take this thing out. He's going to die in septic. So these things do can give you problems, but by and large, they're wonderful devices and they do have abilities to save people's lives. So again, important, but again, if it's non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, you gotta wait 3 months from the initial diagnosis. Now, this one is just kind of closing out because I know we went a little long on the previous talk, and I think the other stuff was really important to you, though, so I'm more than happy to give this time up. This is showing you, if you want to put a pacemaker in a patient, you need to show me a 3-second documented strip. If it's not documented, it doesn't count. You got to show it to me, or somebody that's symptomatic and have a bradycardia that needs it for sixth sinus syndrome. Those are current. But the reason I point the red arrow, that's a nice one because it has a specific recommendation. 3 seconds. That's what I need to see on the strip. So show us that, and it'll be very nice. Summary highlights. ICD is used earlier than we used to. Used to, we didn't use much, but now these things have become so good, and some of the people that are talking to you have actually designed many of these pieces of equipment, and they are really quite nice. AFib, all you need is a heart rate less than 110, and that's currently by the guidelines. If you can get it to 85, I think that's great, and then watch out for channelopathies.